Welcome to episode 56 of the Champagne Comedy Podcast. It's 56, isn't it? Yeah. We talk about the best Australian comedy show from the 90s ever made, Frontline, and other D-Generation comedy tidbits. My name is Matt, and joining this podcast today is Alison, Daniel, Kim, and Tony.
Hi.
Hey.
Yeah, it is 56.
It is 56, yeah. For some reason, I wrote down on my script 57, but and then I'm going, no, that's not right.
Such a rush to get it all over with.
Oh, yeah. All right, and thank you for joining us on this Champagne Comedy Podcast episode. We've got so much going on, so we should really just get into it, right? But thank you for coming back on board, Tony, for Frontline Season 2.
Glad you're here.
Yes, and Alison, after your hiatus from previous episode.
Yeah, I was disappointed to miss the pencil chat. More talk about pencils and pencil grips. Maybe as a bonus I can tell you my pencil grip horror and shame.
Was it a giant pencil?
Pencil grip is not a euphemism. I'm coming in late.
Last episode, they actually spent about 5 minutes talking about pencil grips. It was good content, to be fair.
It just wasn't relevant.
You mean the plastic things on the pencil, not some sort of obscure sexual practice I don't want to know about. Okay, good.
Yeah, would you believe it? We were scrambling for things to talk about.
I'll say.
I'm just wondering that I'd drifted away and I'd come back and it turned into some sort of hardcore, you know, raunchy chat kind of thing.
About stationery?
I'm not prepared. It's the internet. Anything is possible.
It is true.
Hey, Officeworks is now an adult store because of us.
Well done.
Yeah. All right. Ouch. Ouch. I got a point of pedantry here.
Pedantry.
Straight from a listener who has been catching up on the Champagne Comedy Podcast. I just want to say hello to Max Perry. Hopefully by the time you get to hear this, when he reached out to the team, which was only a few days before this recording of episode 56, he was listening to episode 38 of Champagne Comedy. I do have a bit of snippet that he's referring to, and it's when they had Malcolm Turnbull or Rob Sitch performing as Malcolm Turnbull and they're talking about the Republic debate. I made a comment in regards to the Republic referendum. I had a date incorrect. The Republic voting thing where we're going to choose in 2000, that was my first time, like, because I turned 18 in 1999, so that was the first time I actually had voted. It wasn't 2000. It was in November 1999.
Ah.
Yes, the 6th of November.
So wait, he came in with a pedantry point about your own life?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, what is it, Prince Harry's autobiography. He kind of remembered random things. And like, the Xbox didn't come out in that year, and he's so that sort of thing. I didn't listen to it, but that's what I read.
So no one fact-checked Prince Harry's autobiography?
Well, I think once you start...
Even princes get pedantry.
Once you start checking those facts, you start getting into a lot of trouble. I think you sort of have to let it stay sort of blurry and mysterious around the royals. Otherwise, it's like, wait, you were wearing a Nazi uniform for how many years?
It wasn't 3, it was 4.
Hey, man, it's a family tradition. You know, if you go back to like Edward VIII or the former Edward VIII, he kind of flirted with that gear.
He wasn't even flirting. He was just... full-on committed relationship. That's why they had to ship him off to Jamaica.
Yeah.
Well, look, it's good to know that somebody's paying attention to our podcast at least.
Thank you, Max. There's another little bit. Now, this is from Twitter, actually. Chris, Red Dwarf 40. I encourage you. So, you know, when you have your references and, you know, moments, comments, but that's what the Facebook page in this podcast is all about. So I'm just going to give a shout-out to Chris. He tweeted this, I've had this in my head for ages, so I finally made it happen.
I don't want to see a ghost, it's the sight that I fear most.
And I got a nice cup of tea, me toast.
Especially in the news,
Yay.
Yeah.
Somebody needs to slip that in, get this off Triple M style, without them noticing.
Have we got a TikTok account we can put that on?
Yes, we do, actually, but it's very dormant at the moment. In fact, I can tell you the account. Maybe it'll encourage me to be a bit more active on it.
Go and harass Matt at TikTok at
Champagne Comedy.
That's a good address.
There should be, like, a reaction TikTok to that 99 Republic thing. Where, I don't know, someone does I'll a do dance, something. I assume, is basically TikTok, isn't it?
Well, I assume when Matt says he's going to be more active on TikTok, he means more dancing on TikTok, so I'll do it.
Another one is, we're still on the back chat, the news, really, and Champagne Comedy contributor Mason Hellcat, he actually runs the Instagram account The Late Show _ Champagne Comedy. Jeez, we're all out there, aren't we? And he received a special item in the mail.
Yesterday, I received this original 1993 Season 2 Late Show cap. It's the Late Show cap with the green brim. Sarah, thank you so much for sending this on to me. Sarah had been tracking these caps herself for 30 years, finally got her hands on one. The only question remains is, do I wear it or does it go straight to the proverbial pool room?
You gotta get that quick.
And that's the same guy with the cup of tea and toast. But you can see the video. It's on, as I said, the Instagram account, The Late Show _ Champagne Comedy, or go to our champagnecomedy.com YouTube, and you'll see the video there too. And I encourage as well, if you ever film yourself doing the odd quote and it's somewhat tasteful, send through the video. We'll feature you on the YouTube account. But you don't get any prizes, though, so that's not going to happen.
You do get our respect, though, although that doesn't, that's not much value.
Speaking of the street talk segment, there was a bit in the most recent episode of the Team Effort, the podcast Team Effort, with Tony, where they're actually talking about doing the street talk segment.
How many hours did you put in the car park?
Half an hour.
How much material did you get out of half an hour?
We probably got 10 minutes.
That's pretty good.
It's too much.
1-3 ratio.
Let's not forget that Tony and Mick.
Oh, we would film for 5 hours to get 4 minutes.
On The Late Show, on the street, just killing it. Yeah.
But that was in the days when people weren't used to being filmed. So there was no sort of, people are professional now. No, they're ready for their close-up.
These humans were not professional. So how long, so you and Mick would go out with a couple of questions, or how many questions would you?
Just one topic.
Okay.
Mm. But Santo Chilaro was filming it on a home video camera.
Yes.
And no one filmed anything on home video cameras in those days, so people just assumed we were students.
Yes.
But then what happened is, by the end of the second year, everyone knew who we were.
Yeah, and they were doing gear at you.
That's exactly, and it just wasn't funny anymore. Yes. Nothing real was happening. And I remember Mick saying, if we do a third year, we're going to have to go overseas where no one knows who we are.
Wow.
And I think that's what The Chaser, didn't they have to do that?
Yeah, they did do that. Yes.
You get too well known.
Yes.
Just going back to the cap, I was wondering, Mason's friend Sarah, whether she was just tracking the cap down for him, or did she find a cap as well? Because if I had a cap, I would be holding on to it. So, I mean, I know Mason's a great fan and he deserves the cap, but did Sarah also get a cap, I wonder? And how rare are these caps?
Well, in that little snippet that I played, it was only about 3/4 of the video, and he does go into a description of, because he actually has a cap from season 1 as well, so there's 2 different styles of hats. And with that as well, he did say that Sarah had been tracking a bunch down, like, constantly tracks them down. So she's obviously received or has got a few of them in storage. So, Sarah, where are you? Hello, where are our hats?
So she's signing up her own cap kind of business, perhaps. She can get enough and she can sell them on. I'll happily buy a hat.
Yeah. $50.
If she's got multiple hats, she's not counterfeiting them, is she? Like, how do you get so many hats?
Yeah, well, I had a counterfeit Late Show cap that I lost in Moscow in 2007. I'm still not bitter about it, you know.
Those Russians.
Someone in the Hotel Savoy. Anyway, that was...
Was it The Late Show, but it was spelt L-A-E-T and show...
It was the late shoe.
Yeah, the late.
I was going to ask if it was written in Cyrillic.
Yeah.
It was Comic Sans. All right, more news. Now, with the front bar, I don't know if anyone caught it. I didn't, but I did see the social media clip, and they had Eric Banner on. And he was promoting his new movie, The Dry 2. And he
Force
made
of Nature, The Dry 2.
Sorry. Yeah. All I refer to with Forces of Nature is that Sandra Bullock and movie.
Oh, look, it's just...
It is the like large font, Force of Nature, and then it's got The Dry 2 underneath.
Yeah, because the book it's based on is just Force of Nature. And they make sure there's a bit in the movie towards the end where Eric Banner like stares off into the distance over the bush and talks about how nature is a force and it can't be tamed and blah blah blah. And you're kind of sitting there going, just find the body, just find the body. That's all we want.
And he finds the body and he goes, "Gee, it's a little dry." No.
Does he say, "Damn that force of nature," or something?
Yeah, shakes his fist at this guy, "Damn you, nature."
Yeah.
The thing that got it was that after seeing The Dry, like they had a big media-y thing for out at the cinemas they built out at Pentridge for the first one. And everyone's standing around afterwards. It was a big sort of gallery party, which is very tawdry. They said gala party sounds good, but it's just people like standing in a lobby, just sort of going, "I guess we're here now." But everyone was like, "Oh, what are they going to do for a sequel if this does well?" And everyone's like, "Ha ha, they'll do one called The Wet." Yeah, ha ha, hilarious. And then that's literally what The Dry 2 is. He goes to a rainforest. It rains the whole time. There's water, there's lakes, they're jumping into waterfalls. And it's just like, well, what are they going to do for the third one? Like, wet, dry.
The pleasant day.
The moist.
Yeah, sort of like, yeah.
It's going to be like a 20-degree day. There's some sun. It's a few clouds.
It's going to be like temperate.
The average temperate day.
Or, you know, mild. The mild.
Yeah, the mild. Yeah.
Australia is a land of contrasts, but that's kind of the two contrasts as far as weather goes.
Well, this is the little reference that Eric did make in regards to, and it was, I'm sure it went longer, but again, I didn't watch the episode, only just this bit. He talks about the castle.
One of Australia's most beloved comedies. Was that like your first film?
That was my first film.
Yeah. Was it really?
Never forget it. It was so fast. I remember the cast read-through we had. It was just absolutely hilarious in the room. And then next minute I was up the side of the lake, you know, belting into Sophie Lee with the kickboxer and the punching bag.
Keep it still, Trace.
So Nick missed a trick by not saying one of Australia's most beloved comedies, Chopper.
Well, other than that, there was also, I don't know what the hype was, if you knew anything about it, but a particular US artist, there was many of them actually, between our previous episode and this episode of a lot of international bands touring Australia. And one of them just happened to be Taylor Swift. There was a castle reference.
Love you. I'm like, I mean, this is exhausting, you know, like we're never getting back together.
Tell him he's dreaming.
Not good enough. Working Dog also posted about it too. Now, one more. We've got this podcast to blame, to be honest, and I've got proof of that now. But as much as we try to do reunions or get-togethers of people who have been associated with The Late Show or whatever, because of our chats with this podcast, we've triggered a group to get back together.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, and that is...
Skinners are back!
The Sharp are returning.
You can thank us later, everyone. You can thank us later.
The Sharp.
Yep. And that was because of our chat with Pete Collins from episode 35 of the Champagne Comedy Podcast. And I quote, "This interview was very much a catalyst for getting us back together in 2024.
Wow.
And they're now trying to be active on social media. So they've created a Facebook page. If you go to our Champagne Comedy Facebook page, you'll see it there and people are going nuts over it. If you follow The Sharp on Facebook, They're also on YouTube and Instagram. In fact, on their official YouTube account, there's the Champagne Comedy Podcast interview. So you get to see that in full. Yeah, they're reuniting to do a tour to celebrate 31 years of Skivvies.
The all-important 31-year reunion.
Why not 32? They can't hold out any longer.
I can just imagine it now with all the people attending the tour in their Skivvies. All the, you know, forget all the Taylor Swift people dressing up as Taylor Swift and all their friendship
bunch
bracelets
of
and things. We got Skivvies
getting their Skivvies out.
Yeah,
they could sort of dress up as the different eras of the Sharp, the Skivvies era, all the other eras they had.
The Skivvies era, the era after the Sharp, then the next year after the Sharp, the year after.
No, that year was a bit flat.
That one. The blunt. Yeah,
and also one more thing. In regards to our pencil talk from last episode, big shout out to the show PBA FM. They were inspired by our random exciting chat about being left-handed and Ben writing in the state. He actually asked the important question, if you're left-handed, do you have any trauma from learning to write, sketch, or worst of all, do calligraphy? I think they lost followers because of
no.
So sorry guys, but thank you for listening. That is the show, those guys on the show PBA FM.
Oh Jesus!
Yes, it is Daniel G and his program guide, TV Week, Eat Your Heart Out.
All right. So we'll get straight into what was up against season 2, episode 3. On the ABC, Robin Oliver in the Sydney Morning Herald gives our upcoming episode of Frontline a thumbs down. Thankfully, he was very short, sharp and to the point. He writes, excruciatingly unfunny and compared to a competitor, dead meat. But anything that may persuade the regular current affairs programs to lift their game is welcome. So, I don't know, I suppose we could call that a very backhanded compliment, perhaps? After Four Corners and Media Watch, it's another episode of Absolutely Fabulous. It's season 3, episode 2, titled Happy New Year, originally aired in April 1995. As Adena and Patsy prepare to attend an underground rave on New Year's Eve, they receive an unexpected visit from Patsy's long-lost older sister, Jackie, played by Kate O'Mara.
She is still here. Yeah. And so am I. You have failed on all counts now, Pats. This is going down as the worst New Year's Eve on record. I am now being taken into the sitting room to watch the New Year in on telly. That, in my book, darling, is about as low as you can go.
Sorry, how did you all spend your New Year's Eve last?
I was watching it by myself on ABC TV or ABC iView. I watched it for a little bit and then by 11:30 I turned it off and played PlayStation.
I've got to say that, I was spending it in front of the screen as well. Sort of, yeah, watching a bit of ABC. There was quite a lot of music being played on the other channels. And then, yeah, around 11:30 we started watching that New Year's Eve tradition, the Village People movie, Can't Stop the Music, on Channel 9.
Good choice.
The Goot, the movie.
Although we found out just shortly after it started that there was a video archivist by the name of Flemish Dog who was playing the same movie but off a VHS that was taped off Channel 9 in Adelaide in 1983.
Wow.
With the original commercials.
I think there were quite a few people tuned in for his broadcast.
I would watch that.
I love it when people do that. It just, it's fantastic. It's passion.
So I suppose if that makes me sad, so be it.
It'll make me sad because especially when you see ads that are going, hey, you can buy houses for...
Yeah, $20,000.
You know, yeah, exactly. And buy an A.V. Jennings home now with...
No, I was also sitting there watching that dire ABC feed, but on the terrestrial feed, not on the iView. Didn't want them to get any hits, you know. No, so it was really, yeah, it was not great. But every year it's like, oh, what else is there to do? I don't want to go into the city. I'm in Sydney as well, but you know, how crazy is it over there? much better, much more civilized. But, you know, Patsy and Adina, they don't like that. So,
well, yeah, just thinking, considering you are in Sydney, Kim, in order to get any sort of good vantage point of the harbour fireworks, you'd have to be there, God, at least 24 hours beforehand, I would think.
Oh, it's getting worse every year.
At least it's not as bad as New York, where reportedly you may have to go wearing an adult nappy.
Oh, yeah. I know people who were in Times Square, and then everyone had, well, the male people had to bring bottles, you know, and it was, yeah, it was.
Oh.
I've been in New York for New Year's, and I've never ventured outside. TV is actually the more civilized option here.
I did once attempt the London fireworks, and it was a bit adult nappy time. The problem was actually leaving, having watched the fireworks from the bank of the Thames. They shut loads of the tube stations to prevent crowding, and I walked for ages to the one tube station that was open, and of course it was massively crowded, and they were letting in a few people at the time, and so everyone pushes forward. And by the time I was about a meter or so from the gate, there were so many people crowded in around me that I thought, I'm actually going to get crushed to death before I make it inside.
Oh, my God.
And I almost did. So that was a fun New Year's Eve. Yeah, and since then I've been watching the BBC coverage.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Being in Geelong, I got to hear the exciting Geelong fireworks, but where I live, you can't actually see them. So I just heard a whole lot of random bangs and shootings.
No different than usual.
Are you sure they were fireworks,
well, Tony? I'm assuming they were fireworks, but they could have been shootings because, yeah, I couldn't see them. And I was also watching Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, so it may have been the television.
Oh, I was going to say, that's fantastic surround sound. It just sounds so real, like a dance floor.
But basically, all I know, where I am is far enough away from the fireworks and the action to sort of, all you get is just like gangs of roaming teens who look like they're looking to break into cars and stuff. So it's kind of, yeah, it's sort of, it's not quite the same atmosphere as the Purge, but it is sort of that, like, let's just keep the doors locked and stay inside and hopefully it'll all blow over kind of vibe.
You're sounding like a 3AW caller now.
These young people and their enjoyment of life.
I think basically you're better off watching a good film or the coverage of the fireworks on the TV, because, you know, even if you're standing there on the shores of Sydney Harbour or the Thames or in Times Square or something, the footage of the fireworks is never going to be as good as what's on TV, because they've got multiple angles, they've got helicopters, you know, it's all choreographed and it looks amazing. So watch it on TV.
The thing I don't quite get, like when I was young, 1,000 years ago, New Year's Eve was always kind of sketchy. It was just like a lot of drunks and, you know, partying 20-somethings going out and going nuts. And now it seems to be very family-friendly. Like there's 9 o'clock fireworks for the kids, and it's all sort of this thing that like families and large groups go out to do. And I kind of preferred it when it was more pissheads and, you know, the next day the police were just shaking their head in front of, you know, smashed shop windows and going, this reign of carnage must end.
Yeah, that was obviously a better time. Yeah.
It was, damn it.
And then one of them goes, all right, Mick, come on. Gotta get you home.
All right, over to Channel 7. It's Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. And it's a Christmassy episode.
Wait, before you say anything, is it something about they have to they have to say Mixix Pedalic, his name, to say it backwards or whatever? Is that the episode?
I don't know what you're on about.
I know what you're on about, but I don't know the episode.
Is it like all Christmas specials a parody of like Charles Dickens?
There's a bit of a parody of something else. It's season 2, episode 9 from December 1994, titled Season's Greetings. The toymaker Winslow P. Schott gets fired from his job along with his secretary. Deciding to take revenge, he invents a new toy named Atomic Space Rats that includes a substance which, when someone is sprayed with it, makes adults act like children and children be greedy.
Yeah, I vaguely remember the episode.
So I think the only bit of parody there might be the Atomic Space Rats kind of thing, which like all it reminds me of. There was a similar parody I saw on TV recently, which was the preteen modified martial arts tortoises. Over to SBS, and it's another episode of Defenders of the Wild. So previously we had a group trying to save honey buzzards, hawks, kestrels, and other birds of prey from slaughter in Italy. And a bid to protect the tigers of Thailand and Taiwan. This week's protected species, it's an insight into a battle that is being fought between poachers and rangers in the jungles of Western Nepal.
Ooh, I demand that to be released on 4K.
By the sounds of it, it's just like poachers and rangers shooting at each other, and the animals are just kind of off in a corner going, what is going on here?
Better you than me. On Channel 9, we've got a new show and a returning show. So we've had a couple of specials in the past couple of weeks. So at 7:30, we've got a US sitcom called Hope and Gloria. Now, I couldn't find much about this series online. It stars Cynthia Stevenson as Hope Richardson, a high-strung television producer, and Jessica Lundy as Gloria Utz, a tough-talking beautician who become neighbours in an apartment complex in downtown Pittsburgh. The program also starred Alan Thicke as a local TV personality and featured Enrico Colantoni later on Just Shoot Me in one of his first regular roles on television. The reviews are not very pretty. There's this one from Jim Shembri in the Age Green Guide. One day, someone is going to blow the sitcom world apart by creating a show set in an apartment building about a friendship between two people who are exactly the same. No diametrically opposed personalities, no clashing ideas on how to run each other's lives, no annoying mannerisms designed to create myriad points of friction that the writers can exploit until cancellation. They could call it the doppelganger couple. Until then, it looks like we are going to have to endure the continuing stream of odd couple clones from the US. The latest Hope and Gloria has a slightly inventive premise. A snaff, sensitive new age female, becomes friends with a gruff, rough, uncouth female, who consoles the snaff when she is given the once over by her hootie wicko, husband of 10 years who is cheating on her. It is mainly guilt that drives Gloria, the gruff, into the liaison with Hope, the snaff. So her threshold of tolerance for Hope's wide-eyed outlook on life is as predictably and conveniently low as it is for her witty former husband, whose ideas of child-rearing are delightfully irresponsible. Cynthia Stephen was fabulous as Tim Robbins' associate in Robert Altman's The Player, but as Hope, her key direction was obviously to whimper a lot. The chief direction given to Jessica Lundy as Gloria was to clearly make like a truck driver. She does it well.
Well, that sounds so exciting, just like what was that show that Grant Dodwell was on and Shane Withington?
Oh gosh,
Willing and Able.
That's the one.
Yeah, that just sounds like a really bad pun like that. So Hope and Glory and Willing and Able, been there, done that. Meh.
So like, how long will this last on Channel 9? I won't answer with an answer like 4 or 5 weeks. But at 8 o'clock, there's something a lot better. We've got the return of Frasier.
Hey.
Oh.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Toss salads and scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, my. And maybe I see.
And it's a pretty iconic episode, too, in my opinion. Season 2, Episode 3, titled The Matchmaker, originally from October 1994. Basically, sympathetic about Daphne's unsatisfactory love life, Frasier tries to fix her up with the new station manager, Tom. But Tom is gay and interprets Frasier's invitation to dinner as romantic interest.
Hey, Roz.
Oh, hey, Tom.
Well, you know, it's the same every job I take. Word spreads like wildfire.
Oh, what's that?
Oh, you know, you tell one or two people you're gay and before you can blink, it's all over the station. He seems like a nice guy.
Oh, he's okay.
Well, I hope he's more than okay. He just asked me out on a date.
Frasier just asked you out on a date?
Yeah, well, he asked me to his place for dinner. So I wanted to ask you, is there any particular wine he likes?
Well, listen, Tom, there's something you need to know about Frasier.
What?
He's nuts about Chardonnay.
So this episode won a media award from GLAAD, the American organisation focused on LGBTQI plus advocacy and cultural change. It won for Best Comedy Episode for its lighthearted satire of the various stereotypes surrounding gay men. And it was also a breakthrough performance for Eric Lutz as Tom there, as the radio station's new manager, leading to his casting as a regular on another sitcom called Caroline in the City.
Here we go.
Yeah, I should start just naming random series just to see if you've got the DVD box set.
You know, before this year, I'd never watched an episode of Frasier in my life. I was more like just Seinfeld. So I have actually watched a few because, yeah, my partner has watched it over the years and he put on that very episode with Tom. So I know what you're talking about. Yay, I understand the Frasier reference, which is weird. But yeah, it seemed like it was well deserved.
But it's also a very good kind of example of farce in that in Frasier. Yeah, very well deserved.
I assume that episode was written by Joe Keenan, and here is my copy of Joe Keenan's Blue Heaven, which is a sort of LGBT farce because Joe Keenan is actually gay. So you get this quite a lot for sort of people who enjoy LGBT stuff in Frasier because, well, it's very camp as a show, I suppose, as well as being an excellent farce.
It is written by Joe Keenan, you're right. I think the thing that GLAAD liked about the episode is that, yeah, there's no sort of stereotype, there's no stereotypical campness like you would see, you know, in programs of that era, I think. It's very matter of fact, really. All right, so that just leaves one channel to go, and that's Channel 10 and Healthy, Wealthy and Wise.
It's like music to my ears. Wait, it is music to my ears.
All right, in this episode, Jim meets Michael Hendrickson. Who is Michael Hendrickson? He works the only wheelwright foundry in Australia. Naturopath Sherry De Haas shares her beauty tips using honey. Ross unravels airline hieroglyphics. And we learn about safety in the snow.
Airline hieroglyphics?
That's what it said in the listing. I'm guessing that's... Well, I mean, these days you've just got to worry about hidden charges and worrying about whether your flight will leave at all, if let alone on time. But yeah, back in the 90s, it was just hieroglyphics you had to deal with.
Okay. Interesting. I assume she was flying Egyptian Air or something.
And as for safety in the snow, the only thing I know about safety in the snow is just don't go near it if it's yellow.
Yes. And if it's red, run.
So this show is attracting a new generation of fans. It was only a couple of weeks ago that Ian Hewitson launched his TikTok channel. I haven't actually seen it. I'm not on TikTok, but I did see clips of it.
Is he dancing on the TikTok channel?
I don't know, but I know someone made a comment saying, "Oh, I think I thought you were dead," and he's like, "No, I'm actually still alive." So yeah, check it out. I haven't, but
I have. It's actually quite entertaining.
Apparently, he's got 50,000 followers. This is this article's from 4 days ago.
50,000
followers
me.
In a week, with his three posts amassing more than 1 million in combined views. It's kind of like the Curiosity Show, finding a new generation of fans. Now we've got Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise.
Speaking of Curiosity Show,
too long. Oh, it's gone. Two,
is there
three,
a DVD of the Curiosity
I love this
Show?
Challenge.
Oh yeah. My God, there's a DVD of the Curiosity
Show. And they've been
Show.
Autographed.
I found one in an op shop. It might take me slightly longer to find my one, but I think it's trumped by three
signed as well. Yeah. Autographed. Yeah.
Wow. Adelaide made the Curiosity Show.
I think all I'm going to do is.
Tony, there is no way in hell you've got a Curiosity Show DVD.
Whatever this comes up, I'm just going to gesture in my back wall and go, it's back there somewhere.
All right, that's it.
Thank you, Daniel. All right, who wants to do the intro? Jeez, don't all rush to me at once.
I'll do it.
All right, cool. Enthusiastic. Hooray.
Just mentally centering myself here.
Four, three, two, cue in.
Hello, I'm Alison. This is Frontline Series 2, Episode 3, Heroes and Villains, broadcast Monday, August 7th, 1995.
Yay!
Very professional.
Thank you for that, Alison. The synopsis for this episode is that our team is hot on the heels of a racist academic. Mike, just back from holidays, leads the charge. Now, this is, it's not a complete thumbs down, but yeah, it's a bit more of a serious episode. Mm. But I found this...
So serious that it starts with the cold open.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's first ever cold open.
Yeah, and we're at the publisher's office with a meeting with the publisher and the professor who has written a book that's mainly full of statistics. It's all it is. It's a book of statistics. Statistics. but the publisher wants to push it further, of course, putting the spotlight on the chapter about race and hoping to catch the mainstream media's attention.
So slimy is the publisher, do you reckon?
I reckon that publisher, and not related to any publishers that I've had to deal with personally, but that felt very spot on. There are a lot of people as publishers and that, their job is to sell books. If you write a book that's 99% boring rubbish and 1%, you know, hot button, hot take, they're going to zero in on that, and that's what they're going to push. It's a business where you have to sell things, and a book on statistics, I mean, I watching this, I thought this is probably around the last period of time where you could do this particular story, because I think everyone now knows how things work. If you did any kind of book and you mentioned race, it's a book about race. That's just what happens. And I think people now would know. Whereas in the 90s, I think there was still, people still kind of thought, oh, no, my book is about a lot of things. People will pay attention to, you know, my overall message. Whereas now everyone just knows, look, if you mention race or any other hot issue in your book, that's what your book is about.
Yep.
You know what they could have done to avoid a lot of the controversy that happens throughout this episode, all because of the publisher deciding to push this angle, is that if they just had a Mad Magazine fold in towards the end of it, it might have been a bit more easier.
If they hadn't given it that cover with a swastika on the front, it would have been fine.
The thing is, like, in the 90s, there were loads and loads of books with swastikas on the cover, and they were all, like, kind of World War II novels aimed at, like, men who were into war.
Even further back, you would always find, like, all these sort of thrillers from the 70s that would have a swastika, but it was made out of American dollars,
yeah.
Or it was a swastika, but it was made out of, like, gold ingots, and it was like, oh, yeah, those Nazis, and they're doing stuff with money. Oh, evil, evil. Whereas now it's just like, yeah, no, don't do that. Just don't put that on your book.
Did we all spot, by the way, who was playing the publisher?
No.
A well-known comedy figure from Australian comedy in the 80s. She was, in fact, played by Mary Keneally.
Oh, okay.
Who was from Australia, You're Standing In It. Played Debbie in Tim and Debbie, and also the wife of Rod Quantock.
There we go. Australia,
there you go.
In
there's your
DVD.
Australia.
How did you do that?
Yay. You have them in alphabetical order on shelves next to the table. Easy.
My comedy DVDs are on top of like a shelf behind three other layers of DVDs. It's like the last time I went to try and get an Australian title, it took me about 20 minutes to dig it out. So unless you want like a four-hour version of this podcast, I'm just doing that.
This is the reason why I'm now single. So just my collection's just...
This is the reason why you are a catch. This is why the women are flocking to you.
Yeah
if anyone wants to date Matt in the Sydney area, send in your CV.
Written
applications only. Yeah, and send a photo of your DVD.
Hot DVD collectors in your area.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And I'll be even more impressive with the age if you decide to send me your collection photo that has Laserdisc.
Ooh.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. There we go. That's my age.
Must have Laserdisc player and screen 65 inches or larger.
Okay.
Write in, ladies, write in.
Yeah.
I'm glad how
quickly, show me your Betamax.
I'm glad how quickly we went from Nazis to Matt's dating. It's just like
yeah.
a natural segue.
That's why people subscribe in their several dozen to this yeah. podcast.
But with the whole thing with this book, though, according to Wikipedia, though, so there's a reliable source, that the main storyline is a direct parallel to the 1994 book The Bell Curve by Richard J.
Yes, but that book yeah. actually is racist. That book.
That's what I figured. I've not read it.
Just yeah, like no, it's...
I think that man is just as opinionated as Mike.
Yeah.
No, from what I remember, the bell curve is like this idea that, you know, statistically you've got the bell curve. But, yeah, from what I know, and I only, yeah, but much like many of the frontline team, I only read the papers, not the books.
or the dedication page.
Yeah. But, yeah, the bell curve actually turned out to be kind of pretty racist, and the guy behind it was not really on the up and up with his stats.
Because, like, there have been sort of, you know, IQ studies of different races, and they've concluded that certain races are more intelligent than others. But the problem is, isn't it, that the IQ test is biased towards people with different races? So like, you know, if it's not biased in your direction, you're going to come out as dumb on that test.
It's so dodgy in so many ways. Like, yeah. it's a thing that can be measured, but it's only useful comparing it to itself. Like, you can yes. say IQ numbers have gone up or down over the years, but that doesn't tell you anything beyond that the numbers have gone up and down over the years. It doesn't tell you that the IQ numbers are connected to anything real, because the tests are so biased and skewed, and you can be trained for them, or they can cover areas you know nothing about because you've got a different cultural background. It's near useless. And to write a book that basically says, well, white people are smart and other people are not as smart is, you know, not a thing that you should be doing unless you are happy to be called a racist.
Well, I hope no one writes in and decides to unravel more of this discussion for it, because I have no idea. I'll just be replying, thank you for your response.
Thank you for your
this
input.
Is the wrong channel to describe.
I feel yep. very comfortable with the fence picked sticking into my ass. I'm quite happy up here.
Well, it's safe to say I won't be back for the next few weeks, and you'll know why.
We never actually find out the title of this book, do we? Which I assume because they couldn't think of an appropriate one.
Oh, no, they do mention it, doesn't it, don't matter. They? Yeah, it's got
do
some...
They? What's the title of it?
Oh, they put it in the super with the professor.
Yeah, I'm sure it gets mentioned, but it's quite a, you know, innocuous title.
It's an academic-y title, yeah. is it, or something?
Yeah.
It's called Above Average.
That's right.
There we go, yeah, it's Above Average.
Yeah.
Yep.
So again, yeah, the parallels to the bell curve, I can see what they're trying to get at here, perhaps.
We're in the production office now after the opening titles, and Sam asked Marty about the racist professor bloke straight from the newspaper, and they've taken the hook, line, and sinker directly from that. So well done to the publisher. While Mike's coming back from his holiday, Brooke points out that his low-profile trip is in the TV week already. So he gets back faster than he does. And I love the font, the old style TV Week magazine. It's like word art.
Yeah, gotta love it.
It's quite interesting. This, you know, we're in the second series now, and you know, in the first series, Mike's this kind of, you know, try hard kind of presenter, and now he's at the stage where his holidays are being covered by TV Week, and you can sort of. They don't really talk about this in the series, but they sort of subtly imply that he's becoming quite high profile now.
Yeah.
So I think this is an example.
Yes. In the first series, they would have perhaps mentioned how the publicist had arranged this and sort of set it up. But by now, it sort of feels more like there's actual interest in Mike. Like, it's not something they would have had to have, you know, ginned up a bit. It's like, Mike's.
You're not sensing the invisible hand of Jan in this time.
Oh, look, I'm sure her hand is somewhere in there manipulating events. But the way it's presented in the episode is like, it's not Mike is a loser and Jan has to push him into the papers. It's the papers are interested in him as a, you know, as a personality, even if Jan, you know, still does have to do the ring around to get them to get the photos of him with the dolphins.
Back to the show prep, and which is about the racist professor and his book.
Tell me about this professor, Blake. Guy came out of nowhere.
Sounds like a Nazi. Yeah,
that's terrible.
See, Emma, what is he? What is he, a racist?
Well, the book's about 800 pages long. I've only read the first couple of chapters. It's a lot of statistics, health, education.
Yeah. But does he talk about race?
Well, in one of the chapters, there's a breakdown on the basis of race, like what's your average wage and occupation.
And IQ.
Yeah.
Mm. Get him in.
Well, why? Isn't this just a big stir over nothing?
I don't know, but it's about to get bigger.
There you go. So Emma calls it out straight away. It's like, it's nothing at all. But Sam, in his wicked ways, decides to make something out of nothing.
Well, the thing is as well, I wonder how, if someone watching this episode for the first time would react, because these days you would assume that he was a racist. Like, if you wrote a book like that and you mentioned, you know, breaking down things on the basis of race, people would assume that you were a racist. That's sort of how the media works at the moment. You're not sort of, you wouldn't give them the benefit of the doubt. You'd just go, this is some alt-right guy trying to smuggle his beliefs in with a whole bunch of scientific mumbo jumbo. It's watching this whole episode, I just kept thinking that things have basically gone 180 degrees from the premise of this episode, which, you know, the episode itself is built around this guy has accidentally written a book that's a bit dodgy and the media has jumped on it. But these days, that kind of book is dodgy. And, you know, you would want the media to jump on it. These days, the media would just go, oh, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, you've said some racist stuff. Well, you know, we're all a bit racist, aren't we, really? And maybe you've got a point. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, it was like, no, this stuff is bad. You shouldn't be doing it. And we can use it to shit stir.
Well, it's like bloody like Pauline Hanson, isn't it? Everyone was like, oh, my God, she's so racist. And 5 years later, she's on celebrity quick shows and whatever it is.
Yeah. Dancing with the Stars.
See, these days, this professor would be a semi-regular guest on Andrew Bolt or something, you know? He'd be embraced by the conservative media.
Yeah, and that would be, he would, you know, regular media has spurned me, but Andrew Bolt will give me a talk. And then after 5 years, the next book he writes is really just full-on racism.
Yeah.
they need to.
Because there's a buck in
they
it.
They need to do the sequel where he's just got an even more racist book.
Now, Brooke has a potential story about a heart transplant surgeon named Dr. Caffey, and he has worked on a child flown in from Asia. Now, I originally, with this comment here, right, I thought that Brooke was saying in regards to that it worked, operated on the child, flown in from Asia, and then Sam has now said, oh, pity that he's Asian. I'm thinking, you straight away...
Yeah.
And that was the first sign of, okay, this is the straight-up labelling racism type thing within the episode. That was the first mark that I saw.
We can count many more to come, guys. There's a lot more to come.
Too many.
Yeah.
So can I just bring up the whole Women's Day thing while we're here? so Women's Day was obviously where they got the story about the doctor, the heart doctor, and, you know, that lighthearted story, getting some leads from Women's Day. This week we had a feature in Women's Day that had Tom and Rob in it. It was called Secret Lives of Our Fave Comedy Kings. My mum gets this magazine, so saw it on the front cover.
We should have put that as part of Backchat.
We could have. Yeah, we should have put that as part of Backchat.
But it's still but in yeah, the right spot, yeah.
Some brief bios of Tom and Rob. And
Sam Pang and Tom Gleason.
That's right. And Will Anderson as well. But basically, no Tom women. Is some... Yeah, no women. There's Secret Lives of Our Fave Comedy Kings. The same issue, as I mentioned to Alison on Facebook, it's... you know, International Women's Day next week, and they chose a feature on Fave Comedy Kings.
Well, I assume that next week they'll do all women comedians in this slot.
Let's hope. The actual date of the magazine is always a week ahead. Confusing.
I did notice, hard as I tried to look, I couldn't find a name attached to this article as to who wrote this.
Yeah, I don't think people would probably want to put their name to Wikipediaing and kind of Googling stuff that they patched together from the internet.
I'm guessing at Women's Day at this point, they don't put names because if they did, it would be all the same name.
Mm. Yeah, the same kind of student journalists putting together, you know, working extremely hard and under a lot of pressure to put together 54 articles on something. So, yeah, they apparently Rob and Jane have a net worth of around $18 million.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me.
Good on them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know where they got that figure from.
Well, that just means, like, doesn't that just mean they bought a house in the
90s? Yeah, they bought a house in the 90s, that's right. So, full circle, I was looking through my old archives and I have a Woman's Day that happens to be from August 1995 here. So it's probably give you an idea of the type of thing that would be covered in the episode that they would be looking at.
I'm guessing plenty of royals.
There's a lot of royals. The front cover has Antonio and Melanie. Our love is out of control. So that's they obviously.
I'm guessing in quotation marks, but it's in the actual article. It's probably some inside source that's saying that.
Yes, most likely. There's a cover on Kylie Minogue in a skimpy outfit, and it's called Kylie's Spanish Thighs. See what they did there? And
good work,
my
guys.
My favourite part that I've seen is there's an entire spread of copper art in here. So
there's copper art?
Like, is it a complete fold-out? 12... Is there a pin-up of copper art? It's like Pete Smith.
No, it's a fold-out. It is a fold-out. It's got... Super Savers, it's got, let's see, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
a list of occasionals.
6, 7, 8. There's 8 pages of a copper art. So you've got the Italian grandfather clock for $11.95. There's also lots of other clocks. You can get dome clocks and deluxe clocks. There's a stylish fashion mirror for $40. A Queen Anne nest of tables for $90. Hey.
Nest of occasionals.
Yeah, you can get telephone tables as well, which are on casters. And they kind of wheel around and... You can also get, let's see here, we've got some vacuum flasks, walking sticks that are decorative only. Be very careful. They're only $4.
Jeez.
And obviously the really scary looking dolls, porcelain dolls that are $30, fake flowers, and those chests that I actually think I've got one of those lying around, those kind of treasure chest type things that you use to store things in. So, yeah, that was my favourite bit of the Woman's Day. There wasn't anything about kind of heart doctors or anything like that. But they do have some gossip. They've got some Bruce Willis. You know, they've got some Fergie. There's an article on that. There's a Michael Jackson's dad owes some Aussie woman several million dollars for pulling out of a property deal. nothing too scandalous. Nothing that I would... actually find useful or interesting in
any current affairs show host going scuba diving kind of exclusive picks.
No, unfortunately I couldn't see any Mike Moore. It's funny about that. I was looking for him and I couldn't.
That's a shame.
Any music article with Richard Wilkins as the writer?
No music in this particular one.
Or is there any Bernard King?
No Bernard King. An article about someone from Gladiators, Cheetah from Gladiators.
Oh, Cheetah. Yeah, so yes, the blonde.
Gladiators, yeah, the blonde. Yeah. I know who that is.
I know who that is.
Cheetah. Gladiators wrecked her marriage, apparently.
Okay.
Just couldn't face the gauntlet. 25-year-old
blonde bombshell powering her way to stardom and was despairing over the bust-up of her marriage to Glenn Kirk, her first love and private trainer. Life goes on, she says. Gladiators has become my life and Glenn has his own goals to pursue.
Very diplomatic.
Life goes on and Gladiators has become my life. Oh, wait, life no longer goes on. Life has been cancelled.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that with the podcast, Kim. I'm looking forward to seeing at least a page of the copper art lift out.
Oh, yeah, I'll scan the whole thing in and send it to Tony, you know.
And congrats to Brooke for hosting last week's Frontline, and so ratings were pretty good. But Mike arrives in the office and shows his worse for wear certificate. It's like that. It was a little bit soggy, saying that he's a qualified scuba diver. Now, did you notice that Mike has got his hair parted the other way? It's back the parting on his right side now.
So you're saying that Mike has returned from his holiday having been replaced by some kind of robotic doppelganger?
Mm.
No.
Okay. Less interested now.
There's a lot of hair comedy in this series of Frontline. There's an amazing hairstyle sported by Jan later on, which I think we're going to have to do several minutes on.
Sure. All right. Well, let's get to it quick then. So Sam brainstorms off Marty about the professor story. As long as they stick to the race side of things, it'll be interesting. So, and it's time for Sam to push Mike a little bit to get him going.
Yeah, we also get Mike slagging off the Balinese and the French based on previous holidays he's been to in those countries. So so there's two more bits. Oh, and he slags off the Germans as well. So that's four races have been slagged off so far in this program.
So are you keeping a tally? Is someone keeping a tally of this?
We need like a kind of a ding every time he slags off a race or something. So I've counted four so far.
I could put in a...
Yeah. That's a better sound effect, I think.
It gives these little moments of casual racism the respect it deserves.
Yes.
the casual racism, the respect.
The lack of respect.
Well, it's about as respectful as a fart.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, just with that, Mike and Dom are in his office, in which Dom reads a letter about Brooke's hosting job.
You want to hear this letter?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Dear editor, as a big fan of Frontline, and in particular Mike Moore, I'm glad he's back hosting the show.
That's a great letter.
Yeah. Brooke Vandenberg did a good job, but let's face it, she's no match for Mike.
Great. That's fantastic.
Okay, you want me to mail it today?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, and Dom?
Use a false name.
I love that misdirection. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, she's not going to write Mike Moore at the bottom of it, is she?
She might write her own.
It does
name,
make though. Me wonder whether that means that she's done this before, but Dominica's put her own name to this and somehow been caught out.
Well, I did wonder, like, because they make a bit of it at the start about how the ratings weren't quite as good under Brooke, but they don't sort of go anywhere with it. I was wondering if it was just setting up this joke.
I think also that scene where Mike sort of says to her, oh, you know, don't worry about the low ratings last week. You know, I thought you did a great job or whatever it is that he said. I think that's also basically signaling to the audience that, you know, Mike is now realizing that to stay on, well, to get right to the top, he's got to get involved in these power plays. And, you know, he's just trying to kind of salt the earth for Brooke a bit, you know, just because he's the host.
Yeah.
Sam welcomes Mike back. They chat about Brooke's show ratings plus the professor's book as well. Now, with that, Sam wants Brooke to make sure the doctor is a miracle worker in regards to her story and pushes Emma to find out about the professor's background to see if there's any dirt. See, he knows that he's squeaky clean, you know, it's a statistics book, and it's like, let's push the right wing, let's do the Sky News type thing.
Just for another example of the racism, the dirt that she's meant to look for is basically, is he German and does he like German stuff?
Yeah. Does he like Wagner? Yeah.
Does he drive a Volkswagen, you know?
Has he got any Hugo Boss fashion?
Yeah, well, I like how, because Emma was like, are you being serious? Is that a joke? She's like, yes, but find out anyway.
Well, they're pitching Sam as a much more kind of serious figure as for an EP this season. He's not, you know, you had a bit more joking around kind of last season, but he's very sort of straight ahead, and you know, they highlight this later on in the episode as well.
Mike chats to Brooke about her ratings result and promises not to say another thing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh.
Power play.
Yeah. Yep, until...
Really, ratings were down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, everyone reckons it's because Brooke was hosting the show while I was away. I don't think so.
Nah, no, it's probably not her fault.
It might be.
No.
It is. I'm just playing it down.
Hey, do you want me to play it down as well?
Yeah, not too down. I mean, you can tell your friends.
People in the newsroom?
Yeah. I mean, in passing.
Yes, and then in the same exchange, get ready for that fart sound effect, Mike slags off the Greeks. So is that number five?
Five, yep.
I don't know. It's too many to count, really.
Since Mike is in the office with Jeff, he talks about his story about the racist professor, and Jeff doesn't realise that the professor is racist. And because no one has read the book, that's what you would do, wouldn't you? Because it's in the papers, he's being labelled as a racist. It has to be true. So front page, yep. This publicity trail is not going to go down too well. Now, with that, Emma calls out the racism label to Sam, actually.
Sam, I don't think this guy's what everyone's making him out to be.
Well, he probably isn't.
It's just the book's not really racist. That stuff's been taken totally out of context. For starters, only 20 pages out of 800. It's more a statistical study. There's more graphs.
I don't care.
I am getting more and more in love with a fictional character named Emma.
I think Emma's the racist apologist did this one. There's still 20 whole pages in the book. What is the 20 pages of not racist statistics really about? I'd be following her home at night to see what meetings she's attending.
Any German ancestry, etc. Yeah, I think you're making a good point there. It does make me wonder whether, like, I don't know, the frontline guys read the bell curve and thought, actually, it's fine. I'm sure they didn't, but...
No, like, yeah. I think back when they made this episode, it was, you know, the media were beating this stuff up a lot and, you know, they would jump on things. Whereas now I think just the media environment is so much different that anybody who does any kind of book and they put this stuff in it, even if it's just a little bit, they know what they're doing and, it's a dog whistle to a certain section of the audience. It'd be like, look, your boring statistic book is boring, but would you be willing to say that one race is better than the other and we can sell, you know, five times as many copies? It would be a thing that was discussed, you know, and agreed to by the author well before it came out. Whereas I guess when this came out, it's still plausible that you might I've accidentally written a Nazi book. I don't know how this happened.
I think the guy sort of, when he defends it later in the episode, he's saying, well, this is just the statistics. I'm presenting the facts. And the problem is that he's not actually saying, are these valid facts? You know, he's not questioning the methodology by which he derived the statistics.
Yeah, the episode makes a couple of jokes about people dismissing, you know, this scientific mumbo jumbo. And it's sort of that idea that is slightly out of vogue now, that in the past, oh, yeah, science was this objective monolith that, you know, if science said it, it was correct. Whereas now I think people are a lot more aware that even, you know, science comes out skewed based on the beliefs of the people performing it to some extent. You know, I mean, there's a big difference between coming up with a vaccine and coming up with a bunch of statistics about race. And one lot of science is probably pretty reliable, and one lot is the kind of thing where you'd look very closely at the people coming up with it and why they felt we needed a book of statistics that touches on race in a way that says one lot of people are not as good as another lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, the conversation about bias in the 90s was quite on the fringes and quite naive, I think, is the basic conclusion.
Yeah, it just wasn't a thing. It was a debate that people felt was settled. It's like, you know, when you had all that quote-unquote ironic racism comedy, you know, 5 or 6 years later when people would like, oh, yeah, we've worked out racism, we can make a joke about it. And then, yeah, as it turned out, we hadn't, and it probably wasn't a good idea.
No, and it all exists on heyhey.tv.
Subscribe now.
So back to the episode, and Mike tells Jeff that his plan to be more clever to nail the professor.
Let's ignore all the evidence.
Oh, ignore the evidence.
Yeah, ignore that scientific mumbo-jumbo. Let's just expose him for what he really is.
Yeah, a statistician.
No, a racist.
So all I straight away thought was the modern take of alternative facts.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I like the way that, you know, the rejoinder is that he's a statistician. It's like, yeah, because the Nazis never had any statisticians. there aren't any evil statisticians out there. No, obviously not.
Spotlight then goes on to Mike's feature in the TV Week, and he tells Jeff about his holiday dropping. Oh, there you go. There's just some more casual racism, right?
Yep.
and do another one. because we had the Greeks and then the Balinese.
Now, Sam consults Marty over Emma's view on the professor story, with Marty giving Emma praise. So there's a reference.
And this is something we sort of, it seems to crop up with each season of Frontline, which is the EP going, what's up with Emma, and Emma going, what's up with the EP?
With this episode, it seems that Marty is Sam's conscience, because he keeps going back to Marty asking his, or in a way, asking his opinion or his thought.
Well, I guess he sees, Sam sees Marty as kind of a kindred spirit. He's the he's the guy that's like him in the office. So it's like, well, what do you think of her? Yeah. I haven't been around long enough to get up to speed yet, but, you know, I'll trust your view.
He's the hope to his Gloria. You know, they're pretty much the same. There's no difference between them.
Brooke is at the hospital now to interview the heart surgeon, Dr. Caffey. And so that's just a bit of a polish. The fact that he had cancelled his operating room just to do this thing. So there's your warning sign that
he's
cancelled.
You know, someone could potentially have, you know, died literally because of his cancellation. But oh no, he's a bit full of himself, isn't he?
It's quite interesting because, like, Dr. Caffey, obviously, he absolutely understands how to get what he wants out of the media and publicity, and you contrast that with the professor, who absolutely has no idea what he's doing in this world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mike's preparing to read the professor's book, and as he gets into the office, again...
Here we go.
He drops some casual racism with Cor the Cleaner.
Yep.
You know...
Yeah,
I'm not even going to repeat it. Out of context, it's wrong. Even though it's written in the script book, though.
It is written in the script book.
Look, I mean, I think it's lucky. This is the kind of episode you could only do, you know, a year or so into the show. Because if you came in, if you did this quite early on, Mike does not come out of this looking good. Mm-hmm. You've really got to understand that Mike is a well-meaning dimwit to... For him to, you know, his character to survive the onslaught of racism that he comes out with.
Oh, yeah. So hours later, after trying to read the book, we end up having...
And then also doing a very 1995 thing, looking at a copy of Magic Eye.
Oh, they're fantastic.
Magic Eye 2.
Yeah.
Published in 1994 by Anything Enterprises. You can see some previews on Google Books if you lost your original copy, which I have. And you can see things like what three-dimensional cones as seen from above and weird figures sitting down. So
yeah, or a sailboat.
Thank you. Or Tony, come on, Tony.
What else did you see, Tony?
That's a Borat reference.
Thank you. I appreciate
That's my reference for those Magic Eye books. It's like... when Mallrats came out, and that was like 94. Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
Dom checks in on Mike, and not even getting past the first few pages, he labels the professor a racist.
Mike calls it how he sees it.
Yep, yeah, cross-eyed.
Cross-eyed, yeah.
In the edit suite, though, Brooke is struggling to create an image for Dr. Caffey, and the key difference is that he mainly... does bypasses and not transplants. But Marty is there to help her out.
It's the heart. That means life to most people. This guy spends his day saving people's lives. Whether it's transplants or... In fact, that's what you say. It's not just transplants for the doctor. He does life-saving heart surgery every day.
This is good. Now, about the multi-million-dollar home.
Even more impressive. And Dr. Miracle Worker doesn't even need to do this.
Cool does that. It goes from his chilled conversational voice to his voiceover.
He's already written the script. He's on a roll there, isn't he? And I just like the line after that where Brooke says, oh, I think he's a bit up himself and he likes the spotlight. And then Marty's like, so you two have got a lot in common.
In the makeup room, Mike is being prepped and Sam checks in to see if Mike's read the book and has his notes ready. But Emma's actually written out all of Mike's questions. So Sam decides to push Mike a little bit. It's like, really, Em? Why aren't you doing it type thing? Brooke's Dr. Caffey story goes to air, and during the break, the professor arrives in the studio for his interview.
Thank you for having me on. I hope this will clear things up. It's been a pretty horrid 3 days.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll be able to do some
stuff. See, my book doesn't set out to make a judgment. I mean, it's a statistical regression of a completely random set of variables.
That's right.
It's for other people to interpret.
And Mike's just giving him not the cold shoulder, but just like,
yeah, whatever.
The other way.
It's for other people to interpret.
Yes.
And they have.
Now, on air, Mike does push the story across and grills the professor very, very harshly.
You mentioned race.
Yes.
You attributed characteristics on the basis of race.
Statistical characteristics.
That's racism, Professor.
No.
You said it.
Yes, but I was...
Professor, you said it. That's racism.
Well, Mike, I was indicating factors that can be altered.
Well, that's social engineering. Isn't that what Hitler did?
Well, that's not social engineering.
Well, now you're an apologist for Hitler.
Well, I'm referring to my book.
I guess, Professor, you would deny the Holocaust as well.
Yes.
Yes.
No.
No. It's mathematics.
Very much. Mike is very much embodying Godwin's law there.
Yeah, he makes a few logical leaps, very large leaps between sort of concepts, doesn't he? But... yeah.
So I think even Sam thinks he's gone a little bit too far, don't you think?
Sam's loving every moment of it, though.
Yeah. Oh, he loves it.
It's Emma's like going, oh, what the hell? Like, this is the mess that she's going to have to clean up.
I feel like the main difference between what's happening here and what would happen today is that basically it feels like in this, you know, at least Frontline are calling out this guy for being racist, even if the way they're doing it is kind of a bit crap. But like these days, you know, someone who'd said something a bit edgelordy about race would basically be embraced by, you know, the right-wing media and would become part of their sort of really crappy gang of people who say, you know, I can say that actually. You're not allowed to say this anymore, but I'm going to say it. You know, those sort of people. And it sort of feels like, you know, maybe this was a slightly better era of the media. In that at least they're taking a definite view on stuff, you know?
Well, you'd imagine now if someone wrote a book like this, they'd get them on to explain their views in a way to make it clear they were being racist, but perhaps being racist was good in this thing.
Yes.
Like they would be saying, so you're saying certain groups are not as good as other groups. Well, maybe we need to pay more attention to that kind of thing, and maybe we need to, you know, work on that. Rather than just going, well, you're just being a horrible racist and this thing is a, you know, your book is a house of lies, get it out of here. That they would engage seriously with the idea that, well, maybe some, you know, groups do need to have more attention paid to them by, say, the police, you know.
Yeah.
You would just find today's
that
media
exactly
would be
where
more
it would go. Yes.
Would be more accommodating of these ideas. It wouldn't be pushing back on him as saying the unsayable. It would be, at last, someone saying what needs to be said.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's props to Frontline for actually calling this stuff out and saying, look, this is how these shows create these kind of controversies. But it's just a bit iffy watching it because you sort of go, well, the controversy that Frontline's, you know, beating up is probably actually... a real controversy.
Yeah.
The way they're sort of saying, oh, look, the media was wrong to beat this up. I think from today's vantage, you sort of go, well, no, this book does sound sketchy in like serious ways. And the approach Frontline's taking, which the episode presents as bad, is probably the approach not, you know, you wouldn't want Mike Moore's insane logical leaps to be, you know, the way that you counter this sort of thing. But you would want the media to counter it in some way.
Yeah, you just don't want to go quite that extreme of Frontline, but you do want to question it. So it may be coming from today's lens. The thumbs down that was given to this episode may have been justified somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because it's, you know, it's a product of a different time. And, you know, the whole point is to be funny. And I think this episode, you know, still has plenty of good jokes. But Frontline is always sort of walking that line of wanting to educate and sort of put forward a point of view about the media. And it's important to realize that the media, just like society, has changed a lot since Frontline came out. And some of the things that at the time Frontline really just assumes, well, this is a solid vantage point. This is a steady thing that we can say, you know, being anti-science is bad. Whereas now you would be sort of going, well, yeah, being anti-science is bad, but what kind of science are you standing up for? Because there's plenty of bad people out there willing to use science to justify what they want to say.
That's right.
Yep. Yeah. Emma, Shelley, Dom and Kate are now having a girls' night out at the pub, with Emma concerned if Sam likes her or not, in regards to career-wise. Glad you clarified
that, because, you know, when she first says it, you think, what? She likes Sam?
Yeah. So the next day in the office, Sam and Jan praise Mike's grilling on the professor. Emma arrives in the office, a little worse for wear.
Oh, my God, darling, whatever happened to you?
I believe all the girls went out for a bit of a drink last night.
No, we didn't.
Brooke, realising she's being left out there. But then that's where Jan's honeycomb type...
Oh, yeah, my God. She's gone full Patsy Stone with that hair, I think, hasn't she? it's an amazing haircut, but I do remember women of that type would go for that sort of top sort of beehive-y Roman thing Bishop. In that era. So very on trend for Jan.
She wears it well.
She does look amazing. I mean, there's probably a whole can of hairspray holding that up, but she looks amazing.
After Brooke realises that she's been left out of drinks, Jan distracts her about the Dr. Caffey story and praises her work. Dom gets Mike's delayed postcard from his trip to Bali, and with Mike dropping some more casual racism.
Yep, he slags off the Indonesians for a bad postal system.
And then the Indians, according to the script book.
Yes.
Double fart. It's the only time that actually makes sense, saying double fart.
I want to know about the other context, but I feel like we're going to be here for another half hour if you explain that.
Well, hang on. Speaking of changing context, though, we've all about how, you know, racism and that was different in the past. But another thing I think that's changed in the past is the speed of the postal service.
Oh, yeah.
Because this episode, it sort of implies that, oh, yeah, you know, overseas mail would be quite swift. I get, like, from Melbourne, which is 80 Ks from my house, it can take more than a week for a postcard to get from there to here now. So I think they should have been surprised that Mike's postcard made it in the same calendar year as when he sent it off.
Yeah. Oh, mate. There was that one time when I was originally living on the Gold Coast, I was expecting something from a company which their head office was in Brisbane. So it's just 1 hour, not even 1 hour, a little bit less, probably about 45, 50 minutes down the M1. And it took 2.5 weeks.
Yeah.
2.5 weeks. And I was like, oh, why couldn't you just let me drive up there and get it? Well, it's not the procedure. I won't even name the company
for
that.
In the late 90s, I was working for a magazine and we had to get one of those transparencies, a photograph to be printed in the magazine. And I happened to be going on a short trip to the Gold Coast near the near their office, and actually it was quicker for me to fly over there and collect it and bring it back to the office than get them to post it over to Sydney. We had to meet deadlines, surely.
Of course, yeah.
So another installment of Things Were Better in the Old Days.
In Sam's office, Jan, Sam and Marty map out how much they can milk the stories, with Emma confronting Sam, saying that the show was too harsh on the professor as well. Now, Mike comes in with his wetsuit. He's being fitted out, of course.
The wetsuit that he's wearing has adrenaline written on the front of it, which I don't know if that's a wetsuit brand or whatever, but that amused me.
It's not really a word you associate with Mike Moore.
No.
Who says, Daniel, what's the thing? Who says you...
Yeah, who says you can't advertise on the ABC? Yeah.
There we go.
Well, it must be a pretty expensive brand if last episode's kind of fly fishing gear was anything to speak of.
Although, I don't know, the punchline to this episode, which involves, spoilers, slagging off another race, concerns this wetsuit. So, you know, we will see.
Mike does give Emma a lecture about how things run when developing a story, which Mike uses a whiteboard analogy. Cut to there was such, it's like a Family Guy joke right there. Like that style of, I wasn't saying it's a Family Guy thing, but it, just the cutaway for it was just brilliant, where it is Marty and Kate mapping out the story on the whiteboard.
On a whiteboard, yeah.
It's fantastic. And Mike walks out of Sam's office backwards because he's got his flippers on.
that is quite funny, yeah.
In the studio, another installment of The Racist Professor finishes, and it's time for Friday Night Funny Man, Elliot Rhodes.
Oh, my God.
Covering
okay,
the topic.
I feel like I need to read the stage direction from the script book, and it says, cut to Elliot dressed as a cliched Japanese warrior, headband, samurai sword, glasses, hat, and a Fu Manchu moustache. Now, he's supposed to be a Japanese character. In fact, the first line of the song that he sings is, I am Japanese. But can I just point out that Fu Manchu was a Chinese warrior? So already we have some kind of, oh, all Asians are the same kind of racism going on. And then we get to the song, and then which is pretty bad. And then we get to the back announcement where Mike says, have you got a clip of this?
Yes.
Okay.
So, well, actually, shall we? I don't know. I'll play it, but it's all in context.
Yeah.
It's context, yeah. Please.
Lots of content warning.
Japanese, I come from far across the seas. I think your land is very nice, but there's no way we will buy your rice. Your country here is very grand, so I keep on buying up your land. Half of Queensland I've now got, but me, I want the bloody lot. You maybe beat us in the war, but I tell you now this thing for sure, Mitsubishi will always beat a Ford, because the yen is mightier than the sword. Aso.
Aso, Elliot. Or Elliot. Very clever. Oh. All good fun.
Oh my God.
Oh, good fun.
Isn't it something that in stark contrast to the other times where Mike has had to sit through Elliot's song, he really seems to like this one. It's not like he's had to put on a false face.
Yeah, and he's actually quite friendly.
And excusing it with, oh, it's all good fun.
Yeah.
Oh, it's all like it's...
No.
it's the same sort of context as it's locker room banter.
Yeah, exactly is. You can just imagine people from, like, Asian backgrounds sitting at home watching that and just turning the TV off in horror.
After going WTF, yeah.
Yeah. Now, after that song's finished, Mike has to run off as he's got a speech to do at a fundraising dinner for Dr. Caffey with Brooke and Marty in attendance. And, that... speech. Wow.
The cynics told us medical stories don't rate. People don't like disease and sickness and hospitals. Well, Frontline took a punt. Not only did it rate, but we helped raise over $100,000 for the foundation. Now, I know how important a heart is when you're 50 feet underwater, but that's a healthy heart. So something like scuba diving, which I had the privilege to learn only last week in Bali, is fine for me.
So he does have his certificate to prove it.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
He's got his little fixation here.
Yeah. Well, combining his...
Well, the next bit is the scene is outside the room where he's giving the speech, and then occasionally the door opens and you'll hear another extract from his speech where he's still crapping on about diving. So that's quite fun.
Just before we get to this next scene, what do you think about the shooting of this scene? Because... I don't know about you, but to me it did look quite obvious that it might have just been only Marty, Mike and Brooke there with an audience shot from some other thing spliced
in. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Are you saying that they didn't spend the budget on having a proper ceremony dinner type thing with all the extras?
Or doing it in a proper ballroom or anything like that?
Yeah, it's very obviously shot at Rip and Lee somewhere, isn't it?
Brooke has obviously had enough, so she decides to have a breather outside where she meets Jonathan, played by Nicholas Bell. Jonathan is Mike's doctor, and he points out that Dr. Caffey is not the hero surgeon he appears to be.
I mean, heart transplants sound all glamorous, but they're basically advanced plumbing that gets done just about anywhere these days.
That's not a world first.
No. I mean, he's good, but he's basically a bypass surgeon. That's just plumbing and almost as lucrative.
And glamorous.
Oh, yes, all that. Heart means life, you know.
What about the little Asian boy?
The Sultan of Brunei's nephew. Most of Kaffee's Asian patients are rich businessmen who pay a fortune to have a top surgeon. It's a sort of a status symbol with them.
Then why are we raising money for him?
Question had crossed my mind.
Yeah.
I felt like that bit was the medico of mirth burning a few bridges.
Yeah. It's all about what the popularity of it is in regards to who the doctor is and then also what type of thing. And the most powerful ones, because Jonathan is actually working on his own research program that can help more pregnancies, but chlamydia and IVF doesn't sound too glamorous. It's all about the image.
Yeah, you think that IVF would be kind of sexy, but maybe this was slightly before a lot of people were doing IVF. But yeah, the upshot of it is that he says, you know, all these points about how unpopular causes are not funded or raised in the professor's book, but we can't quote from the professor's book now. So you sort of get this guy's take on the book and how people have reacted to it. And his take seems to be, well, there were some good aspects of the book and they got completely overlooked by the small bit on race, which yeah. seems to be the conclusion being pushed in this.
Yeah, that front line and all the media in general were looking completely
Yeah, you know, it's once again a perfectly, you know, something that could have done some good for the community, but the media have trashed it for their own ends. It's just unfortunate that it was doing good for racism in the community.
Yeah.
And the media were right to trash it.
There's no easy conclusion you can draw, I think, from this episode on that point.
Obviously, Jonathan ended up getting funding from doing voiceovers for 40 Winks.
He moves into sleep research.
And if you don't get that reference, Nicholas Bell does the voiceover for 40 Winks commercials.
Nicholas Bell, of course, also went on to play Nicholas Bell in the games. And for a short time, he was a cast member of Mad as Hell with Sean McCullough.
And also the corrupt officer as well in Bad Eggs.
Yes, so quite a comedy career.
And also the reporter for about the moon landing in the dish.
Yes.
I must stress these are not to scale.
Yeah, that's the line.
Yeah. while we're going through actors' CVs, I'll just mention that the guy who plays the professor, John Lee, I looked him up, and he was actually in a 1964 episode of Doctor Who.
Oh.
So he's actually a Tasmanian guy, but he sounds very British, and he had quite a long career in British television. So he was in things like Survivors, which was a kind of cult 1970s British show, and various others. Anyway, you can look him up on IMDb. Quite an interesting CV.
He's the one as well, which Alison was confused in earlier about trying to find his details.
Yeah,
he's the chairman in the castle.
He is the chairman in the castle, but. But also, like, his frontline episode credit is not listed on IMDb, which confused me slightly.
He didn't want to be seen as a racist.
I'm sure that was it and not some administrative error. Anyway, if you know how to correct IMDb, maybe go and put John Lee in there for that.
I'm pretty sure. Isn't that how Tony Martin spends his weekends when he's not walking every street in Melbourne?
Yeah,
yeah. Well, updating IMDb.
Counting how many Carl and Jackie O stories are in the Daily Mail, isn't he?
Oh, yes. Goodness gracious. So in the production office, Marty's eating from a breakfast cereal box that has Dr. Caffey's image on it. So it reminds me, I couldn't find it in time, but there was, I think it was the guy, the professor at the Australian Institute of Sport promoting, was it the breakfast cereal Guardian? You know, about cholesterol and stuff.
Yeah.
So I saw that as a little ribbing towards that, but also the Australian Institute of Sport promoting breakfast cereals like the Sustain and Sustain.
Yeah. Kellogg's Sustain. There was always Olympians on the cover of that box, wasn't there?
In the edit suite, Emma gets Hugh to dub a story, which Hugh asks if he can wipe a particular tape with the professor on it who was trying to speak. He was being protested, so he couldn't get decent enough footage. But Emma is a bit stunned about it. It's like, what footage? And Hugh plays the tape in which the professor states his point that his book was about statistics only and he's not racist. and it wasn't news because Sam said it was boring.
Yeah, and it was made to look like the professor was being shouted down when he wasn't. He got to speak.
Did you notice this, though? In the Frontline book, the story behind the story behind the stories, is that the scenes were switched.
Yes. Yes, there's very little in the script as published in the book that, you know, it has changed in comparison to what's on TV. It's just they swap a few scenes and they change a few words, but there's really nothing of interest to point out.
Yeah, because straight after that, that's when the story goes to air, right?
Yep.
Mm.
And so you actually see the protests and everything else like that. But originally, that story that you see all the protests gets played before the edit suite, but they decided to do it afterwards. Back in Sam's office, Emma is extremely pissed off and decides to stand her ground, really.
Let it be known, and how.
He knew this book wasn't racist, but to say he's a decent bloke in the middle of a media frenzy is boring.
So?
So you fire up Mark to make this bloke look like the devil himself because nobody understands science and everybody hates racism.
This was always going to be controversial.
For a day, not 3 weeks. But resolve this thing? Oh, that's the last thing we could have happen. I mean, what would we do the next night?
And
I know it's our job to fudge stories slightly to make it work for television, and you decide to go all the way. I mean, you're the executive producer, that's fine, but show me a little respect here.
Yeah.
Hey, Sam, I don't know you well enough yet to say this, but don't bullshit me.
That's powerful stuff right there.
I think dramatically you kind of need to have that sort of scene because the whole setup of Frontline is that you've got Emma and whoever's the EP are in opposition. The EP is always pushing the sleazy angle and Emma is, you know, the one that's on the side of right. But like in the first season, it didn't need to be spelt out because you assumed they'd come to a working relationship. But with a new EP, you've got to have a bit where she says, look, you've got your view and I've got mine and I need you to respect my view on these things, even though I'm going to go along with your view. Because otherwise you'd be watching the series going, why is Emma putting up with this? Or why doesn't Sam just have her fired if each episode she's going to be complaining and not doing what he wants? You've sort of got to have this scene to spell out how their relationship is going to work.
And, yeah, I mean, the ultimate resolution is that Sam asks Emma, what do you want me to do about it? And she says, nothing. I just want you to know that I know, so don't treat me like Mike.
And that's when Mike walks in and discovers a hole in his Korean-made swimsuit.
Our final slag off of all the races, I think, I don't know, I've stopped counting. It's more than 10, I think, countries he's managed to slag off.
It's a United Nations of Benetton of racism coming out of Mike.
Yeah, but there's quite a bias towards Asia. I'll just make that point. In this.
That's the end of it, really. And that concludes Frontline Season 2, Episode 3, and the Champagne Comedy Podcast, Episode 56. We got there. Wow. What an intense episode.
Yeah.
The only other thing I just want to mention, and I've sort of been thinking about this a bit lately, to me, the media, whether it's traditional media, whether it's social media, to me, it just seems like the media is a big fucking spotlight. And I think in this episode, we've really seen what's happened to the hero and the villain when that big spotlight comes onto them.
Oh, yeah. Look, I think one of the, as someone was mentioned earlier, the real difference is that one of these people that Frontline has on has got media training and knows how to deal with it, and one of them hasn't. And that's sort of the real divide. And I think if the episode had focused more on that, that might have made it a stronger episode, because I think that was like, that was a really important thing to say. That's like, look, if you know how to handle it, Frontline is, you know, going to work out well for you. And if you don't, then Frontline's going to run over you and just crush you.
And like, I do sometimes wonder whether I would be able to cope if, heaven forbid, the big spotlight ever came onto me.
You'd just run away. There's no way on earth you would want any sort of attention like that. Anytime anyone from the media comes towards you about something that you haven't arranged and you're not in control of, you just no comment and nope and back off, because once it's in their hands, they do not care a whit for you. It's just, yeah, not good.
Mighty fine words indeed from Tony.
It's an important issue.
Yes.
If I'm guilty of anything, it's of caring too much.
Once you take a breather from this episode, feel free to email your complaints to champagnelateshow@gmail.com, as well as check out this episode's show notes for all our socials, and Facebook search Champagne Comedy Podcast Group, and you can join the Cool Kids Club there. And don't forget, if you think that we're worthy of a beverage of sorts, go to buymeacoffee.com/TLS Champagne Pod. Thank you so much for coming on and surviving this episode, Alison, Daniel, Kim and Tony, and you, the listener. And again, please keep stay following us and so forth like that, but don't know if you're going to do that after the show. Anyway, I'm Matt. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Catch you next episode.
And most importantly, don't be racist.
Yes.
It's not cool.
Thank you for listening to the Champagne Comedy Podcast, created by fans for the fans. For more information on this podcast, please visit champagnecomedy.com. Produced by Matt Fulton Productions, mattfulton.com.au.